need somebody. Help! Not just anybody. Help! You know I need someone. Help!
Hello and welcome to what I promise will be another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. 2019 is underway. This is our first live episode of the year, and we are awfully excited. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio, and just across the way, George P. Fraser. Hello, George.
Billy, how are you?
I'm doing well, and I have to, first of all, applaud and congratulate you on a recent accomplishment. A lot of you don't know this, but George recently competed in the Scottish Accordion Contest in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. Came in sixth place. I have actually a little clip of that that sixth place finish. Could we have a little of that, please? Just brings tears to my eyes.
Well,
it's just so beautiful.
You don't get the without my choreography.
How do you get that beautiful sound to come out of that machine? I don't know how
it's
do it.
It's a gift, Bill. And picture me in a little short kilt. It's very, very tastefully done.
No, I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. And there's a legal limit.
I have a huge resentment now. I should leave right now.
I know.
But I have nowhere to go.
The kilt has to be a certain number of inches above the knee, doesn't it, to be acceptable?
It's supposed to.
Yeah. And you cheat on that, don't you?
Well, the socks are pretty cool, too. Yeah.
All right. Well, anyway, I couldn't resist. I felt like our listeners needed to know the multidimensional George P. Fraser.
I'm a giver, and I'm out to carry the message.
Yeah, and of course, today, George, we've got Brennan in studio. We're going to bring him on in a little bit, time permitting, and we're going to hear his story. But to get the show started, let's talk about some steps. I'd love to review 1, 2, and 3, because that, to me, are three of the most critical.
Yeah, I think they are. And number one, of course, is we admit we're powerless over drugs and alcohol, that our life is unmanageable. Number two, we come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. And number three, we make a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand him. We understand him to be Jesus Christ. And it's not that we change the reality. I think where people get messed up on God, Bill, is God's existence does not depend on whether or not we believe in him. Fair?
Mm-hmm.
And let's start with, I think, the fact for most of us, we get into trouble because we're playing the role of God. And I hear over and over in the recovery people that I talk to and people that are struggling that we might be egomaniacs with inferiority complexes. And really what that is I'm trying to play God, but I realize I don't have the goods to do it. And when I get in trouble, then I reach for something. And what happens when we admit we're powerless over anything? Our life's falling apart. It's unmanageable because we're trying to run it. We weren't designed to do that. We were designed to follow God's lead. And then we come to believe, well, that didn't happen on our efforts, Bill. The Holy Spirit convicts us of what we're doing and then offers us the hope that's only found in Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a circular effect here. I think a lot of people look at the steps as we do one, then we do two, three. It's a linear progression. It's not. It's circular, because when you get into 6 and 7 and you look at your defects and your shortcomings, you have to go back and go, hey, I'm powerless over these things, Bill. I might not even want to change these. I should. I have to. I need to, but I don't want to. I need to pray for the desire to do that. That's step one.
Okay, let's talk about this some more. Paul says in Romans 7, verse 18, for I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. I know that nothing good lives in me, that is my sinful nature. So if we talk about sin, John Owens said, be killing sin or it will be killing you. So we've got that to contend with.
So to be killing sin or it will be killing you, I think that's exactly right. I don't want to disagree with the Apostle Paul.
Nor should you.
But I'm going a little bit.
All right, go ahead.
I think we do what we want to do. And I think the problem for me and people I work with is what they really want to do is to keep using and drinking and partying. They just don't want the consequences. And I don't think that behavior changes until we change what we want to do, which we can't accomplish. It has to come from an outside agency. And I think what we need is a heart transplant here, Bill, so that you really wind up doing what you want to do. I believe what Paul's talking about, his ideal self of what he wanted to do, And yet he didn't do it, and he kept on doing things that he said he didn't want to do. But if you really don't want to do them, why are you doing them? Well, he talks about the sin in him. It would be sin is us, and we need an outside agency to change that. And that's what the first three steps are about. They're not about changing a behavior. They're about acknowledging that we need a relationship with God to change us. It's not about the drinking or the drugging. It's us. If you're listening tonight, the problem is you. You are doing what you want to. Now, you might aspire to do something else, but God has to change your heart to what you really ideally want to do becomes what you do because it's what you desire to do. Does that make any sense at all?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. I'd like to take that, what you just said in,
but
for,
you know
a,
what I mean?
In for a fitting. I'll have it back for you Wednesday.
You know what I'm saying? I mean,
no, I do. I think we
do what we want to do. And what has to happen is we have to have a redemption and, as we say on this station, a transformation.
Right, right. Why can't we get our heart to want something?
Well, I think we can get our heart to want what we want.
I don't disagree with that.
The hard part is getting it to do what we should do and what God wants us to do. And that is a process. We call it sanctification. In the recovery groups, we talk about it's being willing to grow along spiritual lines. I want to press on towards the goal, as Paul talks about in Philippians, to get closer to the holiness of Christ. But that's a process that starts with our admitting we can't do this, we don't want to do it, even though ideally we do want to do it.
Mm-hmm. All right, if we look at step two, George, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And Paul says it again in Philippians chapter 2, for it is God who works in you to will and to act according to his good purpose. So it is God who is at work in us,
yes,
to change and transform us and restore us.
Yeah, I go back to Genesis, you know, in the story of Joseph, where the Bible says what man meant for evil, God allowed for good. I think he allows us to go our own way. And we're going to hear in Brennan's story tonight that he did go his own way, but God always had his eyes on him and was calling him back. And what has to happen is God has to touch us, because otherwise you're on your own and you're going to keep doing what you want to do. Now, one of the things in that step is sanity. I believe sanity is believing the truth and acting on it. Jesus said, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life.
Mm-hmm.
But insanity, my favorite definition of this, we've always heard that is doing the same things over and over and expecting different results. My favorite one is, I know this isn't going to work, but I'm going to do it anyway. And that's really closer to the truth.
Yeah,
I don't care, I'm doing it. And that has to be broken by God.
Mm-hmm. So in step three, we made a decision to turn our lives and our wills over to the care of God. Of course, in Romans 12:1, it says, therefore, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. So we need to turn and offer our bodies as living sacrifices.
Right.
How do you do that, George P. Fraser?
Well, I think the key here is to pray for the desire to change. I think where we fall short is we just try to get into doing something that we should do, need to do, have to do, but really don't want to do. I think God has to change the desires of our heart for any long-term contented change.
All right. That is just a quick review of steps 1, 2, and 3 as we are about to get into our nice discussion with Brennan, who's in studio with us. You're listening to Real Recovery. Bill and George, thank you so much for tuning in tonight. I know that if you've missed any of the episodes in the past, you can always head over to myfaithradio.com and go to the Real Recovery page and check them out. Send them on to friends who might need to hear a message of encouragement and hope, because our hope comes in Christ. We'll take a short break and be right back in just a minute. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Awfully glad you've joined us tonight. Bill and George in studio once again. We are excited about our guest in studio, Brennan. And, George, you have a relationship with him, so would you do the honors and introduce him properly?
Properly. Yes. Well, that, yeah, we have all new... the things I had prepared, I can't use properly.
New rules in 2019,
George.
Is that
your wallet? I don't think I've ever seen that in all the years I've known you.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, I never get it out when I'm around you.
No, you don't. Hey, Brennan is a friend of mine, and he's from the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and he's a younger guy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. You know, it's a pleasure. If I take one thing from it, it's hearing the clip of George on the accordion, and so we're already off to a good start.
It's some fine finger work. I mean,
it really is.
You don't do that unless you're disciplined.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so thank you again, George, for letting me play that. I hope there's not a copyright issue.
We're supposed to share our gifts.
Yeah, and you've done a beautiful job. And I'm sorry you only took sixth place. I felt you deserved higher.
Fifth or fourth,
yeah. And Brennan, I think, feels the same way.
Absolutely.
So you got a lot of love and support in the studio tonight.
You know, it's really nice to have you guys in my corner. It really is. So you grew up in Dallas-Fort Worth.
Yep, born and raised.
Okay. And what was your family life like growing up?
So growing up, I grew up in a great Christian home with two great parents who cared about me and really almost spoiled me to some degree from day one. I never went without anything. Grew up in a good church. Went to a private Christian school for until I got into my later years in high school. I have one younger brother who is 4 years younger, and we're really close. And I had a great childhood. No standout problems there. Little bit of struggles with authority early on. I guess that could have been a red flag to some people. Not to me, of course, but to other people. But other than that, really a great childhood, best one could ask for.
Do you remember when you got saved?
So I would say I got saved at 10 years old. I remember it was the night before Thanksgiving, and I was talking with my mom, and I believe that she led me to the Lord that night. And from that point on in my life, I can see God's hand really directing my path. And really, even when I was trying to go away from him, I could see that he was always there every step of the way from that point on. So I would say at 10 years old.
Wow, that's early, Bill.
This sounds so far like a pretty ideal situation in which you grew up. You had parents that loved you and cared about you and looked
for
out
sure.
after you and met a lot of your needs and mm-hmm. gave you a lot of opportunity. So far, things look really good.
Sounds like he kind of messed it up on his own, or we
it
got nobody to blame.
Like he messed it up on his own.
And what I like about this as we move forward is he's talking about how, you know, things were set up well. I can't really blame anybody. I didn't like authority. What were some of the first, you know, instances where you realized you didn't like other people telling you what to do, and how shocking that is, huh, Bill?
Yeah. Yeah. He fought authority, but of course, authority always wins.
I heard that today on the radio.
Yeah.
So I would say the first real signs of my struggle with authority came towards my later years in middle school and in my transition to high school when I was still in the private Christian school. They had kind of an overbearing atmosphere. Maybe that was just me, but I felt that I was being mistreated often, and that kind of breeded a rebellious mindset in me from an early age, if you will, and a disdain from authority. And I quickly got on with the, you know, the class clowns and the jocks and the people who would kind of rebel against the teachers and goof off in classes and stuff like that. So that's kind of where I found my niche, and that would later spur into me starting to use drugs and kind of head down that trajectory of my life. I would say those are the earliest signs of that.
Okay. And I wonder, you know, guys, if something that comes with that is that I got game. I realize I got a little bit of game, and rules are for other people. I can kind of make my own rules. Were you a pretty good athlete? Were you a good student?
I was not to stroke my own ego here, but I would say back then, at least, I was good at both. You know, I played basketball, and I ran track. I played soccer. Basketball was my main sport that I played all through high school. But yeah, and I was you know, close to the top of my class. I was in AP classes. I was in the National Honor Society, and so I kind of had a double life, if you will. You know, with one side of me, I was doing well academically. I was doing well in sports. You know, I looked really good on the outside, but in my heart, even from an early age, it kind of drifted from a posture of humility to one of pride and arrogance and rebellion. And that would manifest itself later into things that were a lot more harmful than just goofing off in class. But that's kind of the origin of all that.
Yeah, Brendan, just so I can help George here a little bit, when you mentioned AP classes, I just need to let him know that means advanced placement.
Hey, that's helpful too.
It was always partying.
That's what it meant for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
So this seems like it's made to order of a guy ready to go out and act out. How old were you when you first started? Would you smoke pot first, cigarettes?
So I actually left the I manipulated my way into leaving this private Christian school because I wanted to go to a public school where I could have more freedom and kind of do whatever I wanted a little bit more. And so once I went over to that school, the crowd of people that I was used to hanging out with, you know, the class clowns and the, you know, the people who didn't really have a lot of respect for the rules and for authority, over there was a whole different group of people than at the private school. And so I quickly got on with that crowd of people, and I don't think I was there a week before I started smoking weed and smoking cigarettes and smoking the little e-cigarettes in class. And that's kind of where it all started for me.
How old were you then?
16.
16. I suppose, Bill, you know, if you're kind of the rebellious guy in a Christian school, that's nothing like in a secular school.
Yeah, so you've got a new group of friends that are ready, willing, and able to party alongside you.
Sure.
You're trying to look for acceptance in your new public school, too. Mm-hmm, so this is an easy entry, isn't it?
It was. And one thing that I, and this will kind of transition into the rest of my story, one thing that I realized that that I felt like I had differently than those other, the other people that I was hanging with was, you know, that I had the ability to have access to money and, save money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they would blow all of it as soon as they got it. So in order to kind of rise to the ranks of my friend group, I quickly realized that everyone was always looking for weed. They were always looking for drugs. You know, they were always looking for people to get them cigarettes. And I realized I could make that happen. So I started off small, just selling a little bit of weed here and there. And that would grow into something that I did for the next 3 years of my life, which was selling drugs. And really led to me getting broken down in every way imaginable. So that's kind of...
Okay, I've got a question just because I'm naive. When you say that I realized that I could be of service to my friends by selling weed, where do you get the weed that you sell?
So that's another thing. I was really good at, I guess you could say, networking within the underbelly of the drug community,
okay,
if you will. And so I would spend time. I'd go to parties. I would, you know, get in contact with friends of friends, and I would eventually find the guy, usually a guy who's graduated from high school and who was, you know, still in the area, and he was selling weed, and he would see that I could, you know, move a lot of his product,
mm-hmm,
and he would give it to me cheaper than everyone else, and all of a sudden I have the monopoly on the weed for that high school.
Yeah.
He just wanted to help out his friends.
Bro. I know, I get that. I'm always curious as to, you know, how I started selling pot. Where'd you go find that? That's just me being naive.
I mean, in Texas, where I went to high school, you could probably throw a rock and find someone who sells weed. It's that common.
Okay.
It's interesting, though, how that the mindset, I'm going to help some people out, I'll make some money here. You started selling pot, but did you offer more drugs than pot?
So, and that always comes when, you know, you're selling anything that's an illegal drug. Drug dealers usually sell multiple products. So that's how I got introduced into, at that time, I had a little hippie phase, which is funny looking back. But so I started doing mushrooms and acid and ecstasy and stuff like that. And I quickly realized that everyone else was interested in that stuff too, and I was the only one who could get it. So at the age of 17, I had, you know, thousands of dollars worth of, you know, product in these psychedelic drugs, and I started using them more, and that kind of was the avenue into cocaine, which would, you know, take a pretty more serious turn.
Where did you keep the drugs?
So I had a girlfriend at the time, and her parents were pretty lenient. So she had actually hold my whole supply, whether that was in her car, at her parents' house. And I pretty much used her to hold my supply because everyone knew what I was about, but they didn't know she would have anything. So I kept all my products safe with her. And when it came time to move the stuff, she would give it to me and I would take care of business.
Okay, so did your grades go downhill at all? Were you...
Not once. Okay. I kept it strong
through
high school.
Did you keep doing the sports and all that too?
Unfortunately, I did. When I started, I had to... quit basketball to pursue my career in selling drugs. So that was a setback.
And how did you appear to your parents around the dinner table?
Same as before.
Really?
Not a change.
Really?
Yeah.
You're doing mushrooms and ecstasy, and they still...
Sometimes right in front of them at the dinner
And they
table.
Still perceive you to be the same son that they've always known and loved.
Mm-hmm. How do you keep your eyes clear? You have Visine, or what were you...
Visine, but mostly it's just acting normal. You know, that's has been a blessing and a curse for me through the years. I've always, you know, been able to handle some stuff. So,
uh-huh. Well, yeah. George, I know this story is going to take some turns, and we're going to find out what else has gone on in Brennan's story. So you're going to want to stay tuned. Lots more ahead on Real Recovery. Thank you for listening to the show, and we'll be taking a short break. And when we come back, we're going to hear what happened next in Brennan's journey. We'll take a short break and be right back. Thank you for being with us tonight. It is Real Recovery. It is that time of the week where you tune in and on Sunday night and hear great stories of transformation about what God is doing in the lives of so many people that get caught in addiction. That's what Real Recovery is all about. We look to Jesus Christ as our Savior and Lord, and the only person that can change a heart and change a mind and change the trajectory of a life.
Excuse me, what was the last part?
Trajectory.
I
had to warm up a little bit.
You know?
Yeah.
That's exactly it. Like, I used to be a wise guy, and gosh, the transformation there has been incredible.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Brennan is at a point now in a story where upon leaving high school, after being kind of the guy that's you go to buy drugs, I have a feeling things have gotten, are going to get worse quickly.
He's on a bad trajectory.
Okay.
That nice. I was.
Yeah. So tell us about your trajectory.
So after leaving high school, kind of the one thing that I would say was keeping everything together was the structure and accountability that my parents provided, really, of just having to come back home to a house where you have parents who would not tolerate you, you know, using and selling drugs, which was, you know, had pretty much overcame my life at that point. So I had to somewhat keep it in check. But when I finally graduated and I left for college, I went to University of North Texas. And really, that's when all hell broke loose, if you will. Quickly, I think it was my first or second day, I met who would later become one of my kind of my right hand man, and he was a big coke head, I guess you could say. And so I had done a little bit of coke here and there in high school, but never really went on cocaine binges, if you will. So hanging out with this guy, I started doing it for, you know, a day at a time, doing, you know, cocaine an entire day and an entire night, and, you know, starting to miss classes and starting to lose weight, and started to really just fall apart with that. But at the same time, I had enough money to keep a steady habit going and make money while doing it. So to me, you know, there's no reason to quit. So with this guy, he had a connection down by the border of some cartel guys, because I no longer could buy cocaine from anyone in the northern part of Texas because they didn't have enough. So then here I am, 18 years old. I'm in college, just a skinny little kid, and I'm driving all the way down to the border to pick up, you know, a large amount of cocaine, and bring it back up to my university and sell it. And at this point, I have other people moving most of my product for me. So just to give you an idea of really how deep I was in that. And so that held up. And eventually, and this is the thing with using is drugs always lead to doing more drugs and doing different drugs, and using drugs to offset the effects of other drugs. And so with my, you know, insane cocaine habit and all the partying, I ended up started to do Xanax when I would want to quit doing coke for the night, or I was trying to fall asleep. And that was kind of the last straw, from the straw that broke the camel's back, if you will. And I was with my girlfriend at that time for about 4 years, and when I started doing Xanax, I was, you know, started to cheat on her and just really, you know, just black out for weeks, sometimes months at a time, and just do really sketchy things. So that definitely kind of ushered in a new era of my drug use, if you will.
Were you worried about losing your sanity, or did that happen?
You know, at that point, I thought I was completely sane, and that's the scary part, is that when you're in the throes of your addiction, you know, at that point, not having gone to treatment or anything like that, I thought I did have my full sanity. I thought I had money, so to me that said that I was doing, you know, what I needed to be doing.
When you said that you had periods of blackout that would last for a month, what does that mean? Because you weren't out for a month, because you would have
been
dead.
With Xanax, it's called a Xanax fog, if you will. Xanax users know.
Okay.
Really, you can you're so, I guess, intoxicated, high off the Xanax, with the crazy amounts that I was taking, that, you know, you can't remember what you've done.
Gotcha.
for
so
weeks or
fog.
Months at a time. It's a fog.
Gotcha.
Right?
Okay. Yeah, well, you used the word blacked out, and I didn't know what that meant, so I had to ask.
Sure.
It's a good question.
Thanks, George.
How did you get snapped out of this?
So reality started to kick in a little bit when my girlfriend actually left me for the remember the right-hand man cocaine guy? We did everything together, us three, and she ended up sleeping with him, and that kind of was a wake-up check, because, you know, we had been together since middle school, and that was kind of the moment that I realized that stuff was starting to get out of hand, and I was starting to lose people because of my drug use. But that was short-lived, and really, I figured that using more drugs was the answer to numb that and just keep doing what I'm doing. So long story short, I ended up catching a case in at the college. I had some drugs in my dorm, and that led to me leaving the university, and I moved to Arkansas actually for a little bit with my new girlfriend, and I had an experience out there that, you know, I still remember to this day, and So I was out there with her, and I had continued my selling drugs and whatnot. And there was a time where I actually, someone tried to rob me, and I had been robbed before, but nothing like this. So the guy fired two shots at my head, and I remember, that kind of got my attention that, hey, this is cutthroat. This is life or death. And, still it wasn't enough though. So I left Arkansas, I moved back to Texas, and one night I remember I'd, been up for a long time and was doing cocaine, and I was, countless Xanax deep into the night, and somebody had some heroin. And, I always told myself that I'll never do heroin, I'll never do meth. I'll do all the coke, I'll do all the Xanax, I'll smoke all the weed, but I'll never do heroin, I'll never do meth. Those are the two no-nos. Well, my addiction had progressed to the point where I didn't even care about that. And one night I did heroin for the first time, and, I never looked back. That was my drug of choice from that point on. It instantly consumed every fiber of my being, and to feel that good for me was better than life itself. And that was when things really started to go out of control, way more than they had. And I started, even before that, ended up to me getting arrested just a short time later, and I was in treatment for the first time. And kind of like George was talking about earlier about, just hating the consequences, like my heart hated the consequences that my using brought about. But I didn't hate using and the lifestyle that I lived for the sin that it is against God. And it wasn't until I realized that several times in treatment later that I was able to make some headway towards really getting sober for a significant amount of time.
I'm back on how you described heroin. I can't do it exactly, but about how it's better than life, mm-hmm. than anything. And as a recovering addict, I feel that when you said that. That was very powerful to hear. And so we get to, and I think we're running up on a break here. No, we're not. Good. I think what we're getting to, Bill, is how powerful this is. Mm-hmm. If you've listened to our show for a long time, this is one of the best descriptions I've ever heard the whole time I've been in recovery, and that's over 30 years, of really putting it into a capsule of what it's like, okay? And it's not that you don't want to keep wrecking your life. It's that this is so powerful, it's what you really want to do. And so if you die doing it, you don't want to, but you can't not do this, right?
That's exactly how I felt. And you want to stop, but you kind of can't. Your addiction won't let you, and I feel like it plays tricks on your mind. It changes what you feel like reality is, how you see other people. It makes you almost incapable of taking advice from anyone but yourself. It's just a sick place to be.
I go to slaves of sin, Bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're a total slave. Your life's not your own.
Mm. I want to hear about how the glory of God breaks into your life.
So I went through several treatment programs. I've been kicked out of three treatment programs for using in the treatment center. So it took a long time of relapsing, getting clean, relapsing, going back. And God really just, looking back, I can see he had his hand on me the whole time. And when he would try to bring me to him, and I would run away, and he would break my legs, give me the consequences because he loves me, and bring him back to me every time. And I started to realize, this last time before I got sober, I got an apartment. I'm in North Carolina, actually. I was in a treatment center out there, got kicked out. And I remember being in that apartment, after all these failed attempts at getting sober, I'm strung out. I'm 6'1", I'm 140 pounds. I got track marks all on my arms. And I remember finally, I hate to use the word rock bottom, because rock bottom can always be lower, mm-hmm. I think. But realizing that, you know, I could try to do life my own way, but it was never going to work until I surrendered to God and surrendered to his plan that he has for me. And that's step one, you know, it's surrendering and realizing that we have a problem that we're incapable of fixing on our own. And that started my journey to getting clean and getting my life back in God's will this last time and to where I am today.
Mm-hmm. How did you come to that surrender? And then what was that first hour like? Were you feeling like you were going to be set free? Did you feel like God has you now in a way he's never had you before? What was going through your mind? Because there are people, you know, listening that they need this moment of clarity, this first hour of hope that they don't have.
And I think that hope actually started with me when I was the most hopeless. I was so broken and so hopeless. For me, it was end my own life or try this one more time. And, you know, when I was in that moment of you know, there's no pride in that moment, you know. There's no self-sufficiency in that moment. And I think that's where you have to get to be able to really turn that corner. And in that moment when I was so broken, I felt the Lord's presence in a way that I don't even think I can use words to describe. I just broke down and just started weeping. And I called the guys up at Redemption House up here in Minnetrista, and they, you know, they prayed for me on the phone. They encouraged me, and I had been to that program before, and God just made a way for me to come back there. And it really has them all over it. And during my time there, you know, when it talks in Romans about the renewing of our minds, that's what occurred for me during this last time. Is when you're completely surrendered and you're you know, you'll do anything to change, and you're really submitting your life and giving it over to the control of God. AA calls it George, help me.
That's not going to help. you know what I think we should do is take a break, and that gives you a chance to figure it out. And then when we come back, we'll find out the answer to that.
It's going to look real bad if we don't have it when we come back.
Well, I know. That's why we might have to take a real long break. And listen to Real Recovery, Bill and George. We have Brennan in studio. We'll take a very short break and be right back. Thanks for being with us tonight. You're listening to Real Recovery, Bill and George. We're having a fascinating talk.
We are.
With Brennan. Thank you, George, for rescuing me as I had to hit my cough button.
You get choked up sometimes.
I do get choked up.
I love that about you, Bill.
I go right back to that accordion I heard in the beginning of the hour. It chokes me up. So let's talk about the word you guys were struggling to find. What is it, Brennan?
So we determined that it was the complete psyche change that it talks about in AA, which looking at that through a biblical lens, I would say is when it talks about the transformation of your mind, the renewing of your mind. And I think that's what has to happen for you to have any real and lasting change, you know, not just behavior modification.
Right. It's a heart transplant. One of the reasons he got that is the treatment modality at Redemption House is the word, the word of truth, and the doctrine they use. And you come from a church, Village Church, down in Dallas, Matt Chandler's church. And a lot of guys from that area wind up going to Redemption House. Yep. And I have the privilege of going in there on Friday afternoons for a couple hours every week, and I get ministered to as well. Mm-hmm. But they're in the word, and the word is truth. And what happens if you saturate your mind with that? It changes you, doesn't it?
It does. So Redemption House's kind of motto, if you will, is worshiping your way out of addiction. So instead of seeing addiction as a, you know, just a chemical imbalance or just a behavior problem, we see it as a worship disorder. So there's something fundamentally wrong with our hearts that we're not, because as human beings, right, God created us to worship something. And if we're not worshiping him, we're worshiping either ourselves or we're worshiping worldly things. It talks about that in Romans 1. We exchange the truth for a lie and worship creation rather than the Creator. And that's, in addiction, exactly what we do, I think. We take something, pleasure that God meant for good, and we put that above God. And anytime we do that, it doesn't end well. And so they were able to walk me through that and see how that was true, not just in some abstract way, but how it was true in every aspect of my life and my thinking. And I was able to, pray through that, to read the Word and see how the Word speaks to that in my own life. And through a long and sometimes really hard and tedious process, the Lord was able to produce some lasting change in my heart. And I'm really grateful for that, for sure.
It's so neat to see. Bill, I always believe that the desire to change has to come from God.
Mm-hmm.
And after his description of what addiction really is, you're not going to change that on your own. And to see that walked out, I know you outside of here. And one of the things, Bill, that I see is we get beaten into a state of reasonableness and we get the gift of desperation. I'm willing to do that. And when he left and went to a phase two halfway house, he got a job opening a swimming pool at a health club at like 5 a.m. He didn't have a car, so he had to Uber it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like 4:15, 4:30 in the morning. And he did that until he was able to get a car. And so, what you see is God shows up, but you got to pick up your cross and deny yourself daily. You got to put the effort in, too. And it's good to see that in you. How long have you been clean now, Brennan?
So about 7.5 months. And for me, this is the longest I've been clean since I started using. So, and that's all thanks to what the Lord's done in me. I'm in my own strength. And I've tried this time and time again to get clean in my own strength. And, I never even got close. So I know that for me to even be doing as well as I am today, and believe me, I still have a long way to go. I still have a lot of stuff to work on. But even to get where I am now, that all came from God for sure, undoubtedly.
George, I am always reminded that anything that is going to be done in your life that's of value is going to come from God. And he's going to give you not only the information and the tools, but he's going to give you the strength and the courage to do what you know is the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like every day you're getting up and doing the next right thing, which Scripture talks about. And your Augustine talks about having disordered loves because you love drugs more than anything.
Right.
So it didn't matter what else was going on in your life. Drugs was first.
Absolutely.
Now that those loves have been reordered. Now you love Jesus Christ and you love his word and you want to follow him. So everything is now going to be reordered.
Right.
And hopefully you will grow to hate the sin of drugs. You will grow to hate exactly, have them become odious to you what drugs have been in your life. I know I just used a word George probably doesn't know what it means. So
odious, yeah, that was a good one for sure.
Yeah, it's for sure a good one. But you know,
no, for odious.
Odious, yeah. Yeah, look it up later. But it's we do have to develop a feeling of hatred towards sin, because like John Owen said, you kill sin or it'll kill you, because that addiction completely took over in your world, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. And I think part of developing that hate for sin is, for me, has come by getting outside of myself and helping other people in the, in the ways that I can, not that I have all the answers, but, I try to, with the guys coming into our program who are early in recovery, or some of the younger guys who aren't really sure if recovery's for them, if Jesus is for them, I just try to tell them what he's done in my life. And really, when you see other people, being in recovery, you see your friends fall off, you see people go to jail who you see the good side of them while they're in recovery. And I think seeing that for me has helped me develop a hatred for the sin in a way that I wouldn't have had I just been looking at myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the beauties of recovery and even the Christian community, with sin in general. So
I would like to, George, the way we started the show was talking about the first three steps in recovery. And I would love if Brennan could kind of walk us through in the time we have remaining what those steps were like to you. And step one, you admitted you were powerless. When did that come about?
I would say that didn't come about until this last time. I think this is my seventh attempt in treatment. And I wouldn't say that I really got to that place until this last time, is realizing that I was completely powerless over my addiction. And there was nothing that I could do to manage my life. And then realizing that, you know, behavior modification wasn't the way to a better life, or, you know, controlling my using, but really that God was the only one who could restore me to sanity, nothing from inside myself. And then the third, and this step has been the hardest for me throughout my whole journey, and to be completely honest, it's still something that is a daily choice for me, is making that choice to turn my will and my life over to God. I think that's a daily thing that we have to do, and if we're not vigilant and constantly pursuing that, then it's real easy to slip back into some of those old tendencies. So for me, step three is when you really understand step three and you're acting it out, that's the point where I think you can make a turn for the better.
Mm-hmm. How do you find yourself offering your body as a living sacrifice to God? What are you doing differently?
You know, I think part of it is realizing that it's not my own, right? I don't get to make the choice to do whatever I want with my body and my life. It's God's. And the only good things that I do have didn't come from me. They came from God. And, you know, when you really understand that, I think it changes how you act in every way. Like, you know, I enjoy working out. That's been something that's been huge for me throughout my recovery. But even in that, I'm worshiping through me going to the gym, me exercising. I'm, you know, because I can see, man, God has given me the ability to do this. There was a time when I couldn't do this, and God's allowed me to do this, and so I'm giving him praise through that. I would say that's a way that I try to do that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answers it.
And then if you got saved when you were 10,
mm-hmm.
Do you feel that God has always had his hand upon your life? And when you got back into a fellowship with him, did you feel some of those old roots come back? And did you start to feel like you're home again?
Oh, 100%. And even when I was off using, even when I was pursuing a completely sinful lifestyle, even in those moments, I could still feel God. I knew what I was doing was wrong. No part of me thought that what I was doing was okay on a moral and spiritual level. And I think that's what the shame and the guilt from that kind of plunged my using into a darker spot. But absolutely, every time I would get clean and I would come back to God, you know, it says in the Word that his mercies are new every morning. And I remember getting and reading Psalms 51 where David's crying out to God and he's, you know, becoming right with him again. That was kind of my posture this mm-hmm. last time getting sober.
Well, George, it's been a great episode with Brennan.
Fabulous.
Yeah, sure. Great story.
Good to see what God's done in your life.
Great testimony and great to see God's power in your life. That wraps up what is going to be, I know and trust, another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. We love you. We love our listeners, and thank you for all the support. Thank you for the way you spread the word on the show, because I know by doing so, you're helping others, and you're doing your part in spreading the gospel of Jesus Christ to people suffering from addiction. That means the world to us. Thank you so much for listening tonight. George, great to be with you again, and we'll see you next time. Have a great night, everyone. God bless.